Well, in a couple months, come this April, I'll have been here at RBF for 2 years, and in light of that, I think there's something about me that you ought to know that's very important, it's very core to my identity, and that is my favorite superhero, okay? I wish this were a coming out about me being a superhero, but it's not, so... But I'll talk about my favorite one instead. So my favorite superhero is Spider-Man. It always has been since I was a little boy. Now, there are superheroes that are probably more powerful and maybe cooler, but I've always liked Spider-Man, and I've liked kind of the story of Peter Parker and who he was, and there's lots of different Spider-Mans, I guess, so there's different confusions about that. There's multiple comic books, believe it or not, about Spider-Man, but... I've been a Spider-Man since I was young, as I said, and I've watched all of the live-action Spider-Man movies. So for some of you who are younger in here, you may not have known that there was an original Spider-Man trilogy, and that started in 2002, and so that was my first introduction to live-action superheroes was the first Spider-Man movies, and those are still my favorite Spider-Man movies out of all of them that have been made as the first trilogy, and the third one didn't care for as much, but the first two I like, and they're still my favorite out of all of them. Now, why am I talking about Spider-Man on Valentine's Day? Well, one, I like an excuse to talk about Spider-Man, but two is I'm going somewhere with it. So, the love interest in Spider-Man is Mary Jane Watson. Now, in the original Spider-Man, the Amazing Spider-Man comic book, she's a red-haired, attractive young lady who lives next door to Peter Parker, and he's smitten with her, of course, and she knows he exists, but, you know, has no interest in him at all. And so in the original couple movies, in the second movie, Mary Jane Watson is due to marry John Jameson, who is the son, he's an American patriot, a hero, and he is the son of J. Jonah Jameson, the editor-in-chief of the Daily Bugle newspaper, who's always out to get Spider-Man and everything, so there's always this complication with that. And so she's due to marry him. She loves him. In the course of the movie, she gets engaged to him, and they're preparing to get married. Well, over the course of the movie, Spider-Man saves Mary Jane's life many times, and Peter Parker is Spider-Man. If that's a revelation or a spoiler for you, it's been almost 20 years now, so I feel like that's beyond the limit of a spoiler. So she starts falling in love with Spider-Man when he saves her life. And, I mean, who wouldn't fall in love with a guy running around in spandex that can climb up walls and all kinds of stuff? I guess that's what ladies like. I don't know. I didn't try that with Crystal and I, we were dating. But anyway... So she falls for him, and at the end of the movie, dramatically, it's revealed when he's saving her life that Spider-Man is Peter Parker, who she knows and she's not paid much attention to. So now she falls in love with Peter Parker. So at the very end of the movie, she's supposed to marry John Jameson, and the church is full of people waiting this marriage, and you know the newspaper's there to take all this in, because... her father, soon-to-be father-in-law, is this newspaper editor, and so everybody's there. All the groomsmen are up there. The groom is up there awaiting her, and it comes time for the dramatic entrance of the bride. So they start playing, here comes the bride, and nobody's there. And so this bridesmaid comes running in down the aisle with this note, and John's face falls, and clearly there's something wrong. And so then the next scene, it's dramatic, and I think it's funny, but I don't know if that's the right reaction. But anyway, she's running in her wedding dress through a park by a fountain where these doves are flying around, and she's going to tell Peter Parker in his dingy apartment that she no longer wants to marry John, that she's in love with him and wants to be with him for the rest of her life. So she sees him. So then, fast forward to the third movie. I'm going somewhere and I'm wrapping this up. So if you don't care about superheroes, we're almost done, okay? So in Spider-Man 3, she falls out of love with Peter because Peter's being kind of a jerk. And she then falls in love. Her emotions, she kind of feels in love. She feels her emotional needs are met by Harry Osborn, who is Peter Parker's best friend. And then he gets more complicated because he turns into a supervillain in that movie. And, you know, when you got superheroes and supervillains, your love life is kind of complicated. So Anyway, it gets complicated. So Mary Jane, the reason that I'm talking about this, that fits the sermon, is Mary Jane, I believe typifies our culture's stance and focus and where they put love in the romantic relationship. It is the core of everything, and where Mary Jane felt loved, that's where she went. So she feels loved over here, that's where she was. If her emotions weren't there anymore, she went over here to Peter, and then it wasn't met there anymore, so she went to Harry. And she was free to do that, I guess. She wasn't married, but she was going where her heart led, wherever she felt in love, wherever she felt her emotional needs were met. And our culture greatly values this feeling of being in love. In 2013, there was a Pew Research survey conducted, and it said that more Americans said that love is a more important reason to get married than even being in a lifelong commitment. That was the top reason to get married, was this feeling of being in love. It was by far the most important among Americans. That's chief most. Now, I think our culture overemphasizes romantic emotion in marriage, and I think that causes problems in our own marriages. Now, don't hear me say, I'm going to say this multiple times in sermons so you don't hear me say this, but I'm not saying romantic, being in love, that emotion is a bad thing or evil. It's not. It's a good thing. It's a blessing of God. You look at the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon, however you learn to say that book, and you see romantic love and emotions and all that stuff going on. It's a good thing. It's a great thing. It's a blessing of God. So if you found that, you're experiencing a blessing of God. But the problem, I think, that our culture has is we take that blessing and that becomes the foundation, the most important thing in a marriage or any relationship. That is, if everything else is torn down, that is what they base the relationship on. And if that's not there, if they don't have those feelings of being in love, then they go where those feelings can be met. They're like a Mary Jane Watson. They're going over here, then they're going over here, then they're going over here, and they don't quite know what they feel, so they take a break for a while, and then where they feel like their emotions are being met, they go there, and that causes problems in our relationships. And we see this all the time in our movies, and I kind of call this the Hollywood love story model. And the problem is that doesn't last. That's not a way to make a relationship last a lifetime. So what we're going to be talking about today is how do we love in a way that lasts? How do we love in a way that makes our marriages last forever? I think that's a good thing to talk about this Valentine's Day, because more than ever, marriages are falling apart in our nation. And the way that looks inside the church is no different, unfortunately, than it looks outside the church. People get divorced, marriage problems are happening at the same rate inside the church as they are outside of the church. So this is something that definitely needs to be addressed, and we need to make sure that we have a biblical view of marriage and love and what the priority should be rather than a cultural view. So today we're going to be in Ruth chapter 4, if you want to turn there. And we'll see the conclusion of the book of Ruth. Now, for those of you who are thinking at this point, we ended chapter 2 last week, so what happened to Ruth 3? So don't worry, we'll get back to Ruth chapter 3. The way I originally kind of planned this sermon series, we would be at Ruth 4 here on Valentine's Day, and Ruth 3 we would have done last week, but because of the snow day, things kind of got out of order, so I still wanted to talk about this on Valentine's Day, but we'll be back in Ruth 3. We're not going to skip it forever. But if it blows your mind that we're skipping through 3, it's a short chapter, so you can go ahead and read through it while I start the sermon, and then you'll be caught up and feel good to go for Ruth chapter 4. So today we're going to see 3 points you'll see in your outlines. We'll see a problem, a solution, and an application that we have. And our problem we face is this. I'm going to jump right into it. Our culture tells us that emotions should drive our marriage. Our culture tells us that our emotion should drive our marriage, that how we feel is the most important thing in marriage. And we see this all the time in our movies, like I said already, and it's not just superhero movies. You see it Hallmark Movie Channel movies. You see it in older Disney movies. You see it all over the place. And so the kind of common, what I see anyway, and I'm no expert in this, but is you have a scene where a couple sees each other, maybe it's the classic elevator scene or something like that, and they make eye contact, and there's this this spark, or there's this natural chemistry, there's something going on there. And so then they go their separate ways, and the whole movie, the plot of the story, is they have to overcome these obstacles, whatever they may be, to eventually get together and, you know, go on and get married and have a life happily ever after. And that's kind of the common theme. It's all about chemistry, it's all about these emotions, it's all about how they work well together. And if they fall out of love with each other, then they go on. Because unfortunately, in some of these movies and some of these stories, the obstacle to overcome is maybe a marriage partner that they're already with. And they got to overcome this obstacle to get with somebody that they're really in love with or who really loves them, right? And you're seeing where this is going and the problems that has. That this emotion of love is what's driving everything and driving the permanency or lack thereof of their marriage. And again, okay, I want to say this over and over again, that the romantic feelings of love are not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. They're a gift of God, so don't hear me say that those things should even be neglected, because it is a real thing if you're in a marriage relationship and you have no romance, no feeling of being in love for a very long time or ever, that isn't a warning sign, that isn't a warning light on the dashboard of your relationship that there's probably something wrong and it needs to be addressed. But it is a problem if we make this feeling of emotion the very foundation, the very core of our relationship. If where our heart goes, that's where we go. Because, and those of you who've been married a lot longer than I have will know this better than me, that emotions come and go, right? Sometimes you're in love with your spouse, everything's great, you know, you got the rose-colored glasses on, and then other times, for whatever reason, you don't have that. Maybe you're mad, or you're sad, or you're busy, or you're stressed. The emotions come and go. So it's not something you want to base the foundation of your relationship on. And the problem with making that the center, this feeling of romance and being in love, the problem with making that the center and the foundation of a marriage is that ultimately that's making marriage or your romantic relationship self-centered, right? Because what you're doing is you're saying, yes, I need this other person, because without another person, I can't feel loved. I can't feel this emotion of being in love. I can't feel the warm fuzzies and all those nice things. But you're making your relationship all about you feeling those nice emotions. You're basically saying, you know, if this person, if this man or woman can't make me feel loved, if I don't feel those positive emotions, then there's no value in this relationship. I'm going to go somewhere where I can feel good, where I can feel these emotions. And so that's ultimately making your marriage or your relationship self-centered. It may not look like it at first glance, because you need the other person. You need to kind of butter them up, and you need to kind of do the right things so that they will do the things that make you feel loved. But basically you're saying, if they won't give me what I want emotionally, I'm going to go somewhere where I will get what I want emotionally. It's self-centered. It's self-focused. And any marriage that is completely self-focused is one that's going to have a lot of problems and maybe won't last. And selfishness is the attitude that we see from our first Redeemer in our story today. So let's go ahead and look at Ruth 4, our text for today. I'm going to read Ruth 4, verses 1 through 8. It'll be on the screen behind me, and I'll stop after verse 8, and then we'll get the rest of Ruth chapter 4 as we go through the sermon. So Ruth chapter 4, verses 1 through 8. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside, and he sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead and his inheritance." Then the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redeeming and exchanging to confirm a transaction. The one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. Okay, so that last part's kind of weird. But we skipped, and we'll come back to chapter 3, but what we skipped, so if you're not familiar with the story, you may have missed. So at this point, what happened in chapter 3 is Boaz pledged that he would take care of Ruth and Naomi and that he would marry her if this other redeemer didn't do so himself. And this is all per something in Israel that was called the Levirate marriage laws, if you've heard of that. Now, turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 25. I want you to see this. I can't remember if we looked at the first part of this last week or if that's something we were supposed to do in Ruth chapter 3. I've got my sermons out of order, but I want you to look at it and look at this whole section here so you see what's going on and how, because all this seems weird, right? Marrying your relative's widow and to perpetuate the name in Israel. This is coming from something that God had in the Mosaic Law. So Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10. It says, if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside of the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him, and if he persists, saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and she shall answer and say, so it shall be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal pulled off. So that's quite the title to have for the rest of your life, right? The man, the one who had his sandal pulled off. So what is going on there? So what would happen is if an Israelite man died without children, then ideally his brother, if he's got brothers, his nearest brother, would marry the woman, take her as his wife, have children with her, then the oldest son would then, when he reached age, when he became an adult, he would not only continue the family line, because it would be as if he were the deceased brother's son, but he would also then inherit his family's land, so his father's land or property or whatever, and then continue on according to the family line. And so they were to do that so that families didn't die out in Israel, and so that land that the Lord had given to certain families in Israel would not end up in the hands of other families. That was important to the Lord. That's why you have the year of Jubilee, which historically there's no evidence that this actually happened, but after so many years, after 7 years, there was to be a forgiveness, land was returned to people who had debts and all that stuff, so stuff stayed with the family, that property stayed with the family, and so that's kind of what's going on here. So this is all kind of weird to us because it's so foreign to our culture and foreign to our idea, but that's kind of what's going on. So Boaz, remember, was related to Elimelech, so he could marry Ruth. He could be a redeemer. But the problem was there was somebody, and we don't have his name here in Ruth, but there was somebody who was closer in relation to Ruth and Ruth's husband than Boaz was. So he had the first right of refusal because he was closer in relation. So he had to decide whether he wanted to redeem and marry Ruth and continue the family line or not, according to what we see in Deuteronomy 25. So what Boaz does is, he tells Ruth, he says, okay, I'm going to take care of this. I will make sure you're married. If not by me, then your closer relative. So he goes, he finds this relative. He asks him to come. He asks elders in the city to come, and they sat in the city gate. Now, I always pictured when I was younger that they're, you know, just kind of in the way, sitting smack dab in the middle of the gate. You know, there's these cows and stuff going around them and all that kind of stuff. And when I was in Israel, now, I may be getting things confused because different ages had different building structures and technologies, but the city ruins that I saw, the city gate, they had little like rooms off to the side of the gate. So as you come in, you're kind of going and you're going past these rooms. And those were kind of where you did the city business in these little rooms. And so that's probably where they are. They're not, you know, sitting right on the ground, right in the middle of everything when everybody's trying to walk by and do everything. So they go there, and what Boaz does is he reveals something, one, that we're not aware of, and then he proposes all of this in an interesting way. It almost seems kind of deceitful in the way that he does it. What he does is he reveals, okay, Naomi has this land that belonged to her husband that she's selling. So this is new information for us as the audience. And so it's the Redeemer's first right of refusal whether he's going to buy the land. So he doesn't mention anything about Ruth, but he proposes this. And so the Redeemer considers this and he decides he's going to do his righteous duty of being the Redeemer. He's going to redeem the land. He's going to buy it. He's going to take this. Now, in his mind, no doubt, there is financial incentive for doing this because if it's just the land, right, he's going to buy the land. He's going to give up some money to Naomi for this land, but he can farm it. He can earn that money back and then some. He's going to have that land for good because there's nobody to inherit it. Well, then Boaz mentions, oh, by the way, and this isn't because he forgot Ruth. He's doing this for a reason. But he says, by the way, when you buy this land, you also have to redeem Ruth the Moabite who came back with Naomi. You have to perform the Levirate marriage with her. You have to, if she produces a son, then he will take after the name. He will become the inheritor of Elimelech, all of his property. So he will take that land back then, is what would happen, that he bought. And not only that land, but he would also be one of this man's children, sons. So he would have part of his inheritance as well, part of the wealth of whoever this redeemer is. So it would really be a financial sacrifice because not only would he have to give back the land that he bought and everything that belonged to Elimelech, but he would have to give some of his own possessions, some of his own inheritance, what he would normally give out to his children. So it would become a sacrifice then. It would become something that he would have to give of himself for to redeem for the sake of his family. So at that point, when he becomes aware of this, that, oh, well, you know, this is not going to be financially advantageous, then this redeemer backs away and he decides, I can't redeem Ruth. So that's why he says that it would endanger his own inheritance. That's something that right away we may not realize how that works. But once a son becomes an adult, he's going to take back that property and take some of his own property and wealth with him too. So that's why that was the case. So he refuses. Now, what Boaz has done in revealing things and revealing it in the order that he's done, he's shown the town elders who are there witnessing that this redeemer, it's not a matter of, you know, he really would redeem, but he can't do it, or he's revealed that the man has selfish motives. He's not going to perform his familial, loving, self-sacrificial duty for his relative in taking Ruth and providing for her, caring for her, doing all of that. What he wants is financial advantage. He thinks, oh, if it's just a field, that's good for me. I can make money, but I'll be the good guy. I'll take one for the team. I'll be the redeemer and buy this land. But then when he realizes it's actually going to cost him, then he wants no part of it. So Boaz has acted kind of cunningly here. And so then Boaz is free. The man takes off his sandal and gives it to Boaz, which is weird to us what's going on. And I don't think that's what we see in Deuteronomy about the shameful act of having the title of the man who had his sandal removed on his house forever. Because in Ruth chapter 4, verse 7, it says that this is what they used to do in Israel as a way of attesting. It's kind of like a receipt. So this is something that was cultural that they did at the time of Ruth that wasn't even practiced whenever Ruth was written. It's something they have to explain. It's kind of like if you're explaining to somebody, you know, back in the olden days, we had to use our fingers and rotate the phone numbers. You couldn't just press. It was something like that. It was something that wasn't practiced anymore in this culture. So I don't think this is that shameful thing that we saw in Deuteronomy. It's something different. So now that Boaz has got the sandal, then he redeems Ruth and he marries her. Now, what the point I want to make with this, and this is our solution, is that lasting love is sacrificial love for the other person. Lasting love is sacrificial love for the other person. Love that lasts forever is done for the other person, and it usually costs us something. It's not selfish love that's just looking at what can we get out of the relationship, how can I feel, what advantages are there for me. It's love that you do for the sake of the other person. This is the love that Boaz had for Ruth. Boaz exemplifies this selfless love. So let's see that in the rest of our passage. Ruth 4, I'll start in verse 9 and then just read all the way through the end of the chapter. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon and also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon. I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. And Amminadab fathered Nahshon. And Nahshon fathered Salmon. And Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. So there's a lot there. Boaz redeems, and he marries Ruth. And this is an act of self-sacrifice because, remember, Boaz now not only has to provide for Ruth and Naomi, you know, their food, their clothing, all the stuff they need. He's taking them into his household, into his care. He's got to do that, which is expensive of his own right. Those of you who have many children or adding children, all that stuff, you know, the more people you add into your household, the more expensive it is, right? So he's got to do that. And then, not only that, but if there's a son, and there is, when he becomes an adult, then he's going to inherit not only his ancestors' land, not only Elimelech's land and inheritance, but also some of Boaz's as well. And so that would be a sacrifice. It may perturb if Boaz had other wives or a wife and children. It would take away some of their inheritance, so that would kind of irritate them. And so this was an act of self-sacrifice that Boaz is doing, not for his own benefit, but for the sake of Ruth and Naomi. Now, there are a lot of people who see this marriage as a great romantic moment, right? You know, finally, at the end of the story, the guy gets the girl. Boaz has been after this attractive young Moabite girl this whole time, and finally he's overcome these odds and, you know, outwitted this redeemer who wouldn't treat her right, and now he's got her, and the girl's got this handsome man that now she's with and she has forever, and I don't see that. This is an act of self-sacrifice. Now, that's not to say that there's no it was impossible that there was romantic attraction there, or that, you know, Boaz and Ruth weren't good looking. I don't know. The Bible doesn't have pictures, so they may have been good looking people or maybe not. I don't know. You have to look at the children's Bible for the pictures there. I'm not sure. But it's not necessarily this great romantic moment for Boaz where, you know, finally he rides off into the sunset and all is happily ever after. This is an act of love, of self-sacrifice, where he's giving of himself and his family is sacrificing as well. And it may not cost just Boaz financially. It may cause some tension with his other wife, if he has one. We're not told in the Bible if he does or not. But I would assume, Chris Albin's opinion here, but I would assume that he probably does, just because of his age and the culture of the time. Polygamy was regularly practiced, and you didn't have a lot of single older men running around, right? You got old enough, you had a wife or wives, that's what you did to perpetuate the family name. That was very important. And so if he had another wife or wives, You know, they may not be too happy about sharing some of this inheritance with this other son that's coming along. You know, the more wives you get, the more marriage tension it is. We never see that go well in the Bible. So there may be some emotional strain. There may be some relational strain, all of that going on. So for Boaz, this is an act of self-sacrificial love. And remember, it also is for Ruth, too, because remember in sermons past that Ruth, Boaz praised her for not going after the younger men and rather doing what would serve Naomi. Ruth could have gone off and stayed in her native land of Moab, or she could have pursued younger men in Israel that maybe she thought was more attractive or that could serve her needs better, but she didn't. She did what would serve Naomi. So in a way, this is a sacrifice for Ruth. How much of a sacrifice, we don't know. Again, we don't know what Boaz looked like. We don't know that what the age difference is. We don't know a lot of these things. But for both of them, it's an act of loving self-sacrifice. Boaz for Ruth and Naomi, Ruth for Naomi, and then I'm sure she loved Boaz well in addition to that. So, all this to say, we've got this genealogy going on at the end. So what's that all about? Boaz's act of self-sacrifice was not just a blessing to Ruth and Naomi, because now Naomi has a future, right? Remember, she wanted everybody to call her Mara. She was in the throes of bitterness. Now she's blessed. Now she has a hope. Now she has a son. It's like she has her own a son again, and that the family name is going to continue. Her needs are going to be provided for. So it's a blessing for them, but it also becomes a blessing for the rest of Israel and eventually the rest of the world, right? It's a blessing for Israel because eventually one of the descendants of this son, Obed, is David, King David. This is the David that defeated Goliath and that became king of Israel, led them into the golden age and was called a man after God's own heart. And that's a great blessing. Without this, without Boaz's act, there would be no David. And of course, God's orchestrating all of this. God is the one in control of what's going on. But one key reason that Ruth was written and recorded was to show Israel where David came from, to show that even in the time of Judges, a time of great wickedness and evil in Israel, where people were doing what was right in their own eyes, David came from godly stock, from family, from one of those families, a remnant in Israel who are pursuing the Lord, who are loving as they were supposed to, being self-sacrificial. David came along and became a blessing to Israel, and then also to the whole world, right? Because along down the line of David's descendants, we have Jesus, right? The Redeemer of the whole world, our Redeemer. So our application for today, all this is to say that we need to love loyally and sacrificially. We need to love loyally and we need to love sacrificially. That's how we are to love in our relationships, especially our romantic relationships. Love your future spouse or your present spouse loyally and sacrificially. We're to love like Boaz because Boaz loved like Jesus. Boaz really exemplifies God's self-sacrificial love. This is hesed love. I mentioned that before. That's the Hebrew word for love, covenantal love. So it's based on this promise, this covenant love. It's not based on where the heart goes, whether, you know, I'm in love over here. That's kind of the, I'm gonna coin this, so if this takes off, I started it, and I'll probably get into copyright problems. But anyway, Mary Jane Watson syndrome, okay? If you got the Mary Jane Watson syndrome, you're going over here where your heart goes, you're going over here, you're going over there, you're just following your heart. But covenantal love is you make a promise, I'm going to love you. I'm going to stay in this relationship no matter what, no matter if I feel like I'm being loved at this moment or not. I am going to stay and I'm going to love you. And that's the love that God shows his people. Because over and over again in the Bible, we see that God's people do not live up to their end of the covenant, right? Israel didn't. The church doesn't. We don't, right? We sin. We're always running off. We're doing what we want to do. And yet God is faithful. He is following covenantal love. And there are people who rightly see a parallel between Boaz and Jesus, right? Because Boaz was the redeemer in the story. He's the good guy, self-sacrificial love, who redeemed not only Naomi, a Jew, and the rest of her family, but also Ruth, who was a Gentile. And then on down the line, down his descendants, you've got Jesus, the ultimate redeemer, right? The redeemer of the whole world, both Jews and Gentiles, who gave himself self-sacrificially for the sake of the world, part of that covenantal love, that whoever believes in him, he's going to save. And he will be their advocate. He will be their intercessor forever and ever, whether we're completely faithful or not. It's that covenantal, self-sacrificial love. And that wasn't because of anything that we did to earn it. It was because Jesus gave of himself self-sacrificially for the sake of the world. And emotions come and go. That's the problem with having that as the foundation. Again, not that romantic love is evil, not that it's bad. It's a good thing. It's a good barometer for if there's no romantic love, that should be a warning light on the dashboard of your relationship that something's wrong, something needs to get fixed, somebody needs to change something, both people need to change something, there might need to be work. But the emotions come and go even in a healthy marriage where you wake up and you think, I do not feel like kissing or hugging or dealing with this person. I just kind of want to go on my own way, and they can do their thing. I'll do my thing. And it could be a number of things, not necessarily because everything's falling apart or that somebody's wrong somebody. Maybe you're tired, you're stressed, but it's not the romance, lovey-dovey, you run off into the sunset arm-in-arm moment, right, all the time. It's not. The emotions come and they go. But if you have that covenantal love, that love where you've promised to love and serve them self-sacrificially, that's how you make a marriage last. That's how you keep a marriage permanent, because it's based on a permanent promise that you've made not only with the other person, but with God, right? And you're going to love like God loves you. And that's when Dylan read the passage in Ephesians. That's what we see. That's why a wife is supposed to submit to her husband. And that's why a husband is to love his wife, is because that's how Jesus loves. That's to be the model. So just as a wife submits to the husband, so the church submits to Christ. And just as Christ loves self-sacrificially the church, so should the husband love self-sacrificially the wife. It's that self-sacrificial love that both people in a relationship are supposed to do, because that is how Jesus, that is how God loves us. And that's what we're called to do, is we're to love loyally and sacrificially. Not according to the Mary Jane syndrome, not running here and there where our heart leads, but where we've made our covenants, where we've promised. So if you want love that lasts, you must love loyally and sacrificially, like Boaz did for Ruth, and like Ruth did for Naomi as well. You must love with a loyal covenantal love. And our culture will continually tell you, and I've not read any self-help books on your marriage from a secular standpoint. I just haven't. Haven't had an interest in it, so it may say something different than what I see in Hollywood and everything else. But what I see broadly in our culture and our movies dramatically affect how we think, and it dramatically affects our culture in many ways. But what I see there is constantly in different ways advocating where your heart goes, where you're happy, go there. Go where it makes you happy. And it's not, I don't want to present a view of marriage where, it's self-sacrificial love, where, you're just beating yourself down emotionally all the time and it's never good. And that's not the case. If both people are loving loyally and self-sacrificially, you're both going to have your needs met. You are going to have that romance. You are going to have your needs met because the other person's worried about you and you're worried about them. And the perfect marriage would only have fights about, no, I want to do what you want. No, I want to do what you want. And, that kind of stuff. And that's not the world we live in all the time, right? But that is ideal, where each person is focused on the other. And that's the love that we are to have, not this emotional running wherever your heart leads. And if that's the foundation, if we take the cultural view and put that as the very foundation of our marriage, where, we can endure anything, but if we don't feel loved, if we don't feel like our emotional needs are getting met, then we're going to go where they are. The relationship's not going to last. You're going to be going here and there, and wherever your heart goes, wherever the emotions go, because emotions are, they come and they go. That's the way they go. So remember that. Love like Boaz, Love loyally, love self-sacrificially. Remember that this Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day is exciting. It's all about, you're probably going to do things that are, I lost my thought, but anyway, you're going to do things that are, this is why I'm not a hopeless romantic. I get so close and then fall off the cliff, but anyway, start running around in spandex, but anyway. Love loyally and love self-sacrificially. Don't fall into the cultural mode of love. Let's close in prayer.